ABC News, I'm Mark Remillar. Demonstrators gathering in Jerusalem today, the latest protest in the country calling for new elections and the removal of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu over his tactics in Israel's war against Hamas. Meanwhile, President Biden now facing criticism from some in his own party over his plan to send more fighter jets and bombs to Israel. Work continuing to cut up portions of twisted metal from the wreckage of the Francis Scott Key Bridge so it can be removed from the water and hauled away. Work is being conducted at the surface right now, says Maryland's Governor Wes Moore.
We have divers that are sitting on 24/7 standby. As soon as the conditions become safe enough for them to go back in the water, they go back in the water and they'll continue the recovery operations.
It's still not clear when the busy port of Baltimore will reopen. Turkey's main opposition party appears set to retain control over key cities in the country, according to preliminary results from local elections this weekend. The victory is a major upset to President Erdogan. This is ABC News. Many fast food franchise owners in California say they're not happy to see a boost to the minimum wage kick in tomorrow.
California's $20 an hour minimum wage law is intended to help the large number of adults who work in the fast food industry. But fast food owners and operators like Carrie Harper Howie say it's too specific.
So that's the fast food industry. That's not all restaurants. That's not all people making minimum wage.
Her family owns McDonald's franchises throughout Los Angeles. She says they're prepared to absorb additional losses, but there will not be a massive price increase. Brian Clark, ABC News.
Harvard University says it's removed human skin from the binding of a 19th century book on the afterlife that it's been in its collection since the 1930s. The decision comes after ethical concerns over the book's origin and history. The book was written by a French novelist and poet in the 1880s. A physician who was gifted it bound it with human skin without consent, according to the university. I'm Mark Remillard, ABC News.
Keeping you informed, entertained, and connected to your local community. Here's Terry Barr with the Civic Media Radio Network.
If it seems you are being asked to donate pretty often these days, Lisa Schiller with the Wisconsin Better Business Bureau says you probably are, and she's hearing from residents about it.
They're getting aggressive calls, they're getting mailers in the mail asking for donations, and they want to know where their money is going.
Schiller says ask questions and understand the difference between a political action committee 527 and a nonprofit charity.
You have to really pay attention to name confusion. The use of the words police and firefighter, veterans, cancer. The name of the organization does not necessarily mean that the charity is engaged in these issues. And I think that's the important thing to remember.
Find more information at BBB.org. Until next time, I'm Terry Barr.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Wisconsin is one of the first states to join a new effort to get nutritious food to children from low-income families during the summer. Here's Mike Moe.
Governor Tony Evers says Wisconsin is the first state to get the green light for the summer electronic benefit transfer program. 36 other states are poised to launch this summer, too. Eligible households will receive preloaded debit cards that families can use to buy groceries. Shelley Fortner of the Hunger Task Force of La Crosse applauds the move, noting half of the kids in the local school district already qualify for free and reduced price lunches during school.
We've got families with low incomes, most of them working, by the way, but just not able to put that extra meal on the table for kids who are home during the summer months.
This new permanent program, authorized by Congress, is similar to the enhanced meal access the federal government provided during the pandemic. Throughout Wisconsin, there are separate meal sites for these kids when school isn't in session, but supporters of the new effort say it provides more flexibility, especially for households with limited transportation options. State officials point out that most families already enrolled in the National School Lunch Program will automatically receive the summer benefits. Fortner says meal access aids kids in their learning. For the summer, she says the additional access will help keep them active.
We've had a lot of information about, you know, sedentary activities like video games and TV and all of that. But our kids are now getting outdoors more, and they need to have that energy to be able to keep that up.
She adds this should help foster healthy lifelong habits for kids and prevent them from starting the next school year feeling sluggish. It's anticipated the money will be available in late June. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Everybody, Todd Allball, Monday noon to 2, it's the Cheese, Beer, and Radio Tour starting in Richland Center with Travy Olson. Don't miss it on the Civic Media Radio Network.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. On this Easter Sunday, plenty of clouds to contend with. Southeast winds developing, highs in the mid-40s. If you don't see some rain late in the day, it will arrive by Sunday night. Mostly cloudy, lower 30s. Rain chances continue Monday with highs in the mid-40s. Currently 44 degrees.
Your home for the Devil's Advocates. Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6. The Talk of Green Bay. 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
Welcome to this, our weekly, our weekend broadcast. My name is Jim Santel. And yes, for this hour and next hour as well, I'm going to be your host on this broadcast of Civic Media, also being carried on 12 broadcast stations throughout the Civic Media communities, throughout the state of Wisconsin and beyond. This is our 91st broadcast, although our second broadcast under our new name, Amicus, a Law Review. Delighted to have you with me this morning and beyond throughout this weekend for our presentation of issues related to law, justice, and the aspiration for justice in our nation and beyond. As always, we're going to be taking your phone calls as well this hour and next hour. That number is 855-752-4842. For those of you who are new to our newly restyled and reimagined broadcast, Amicus, a Law Review, a little bit of reintroduction once again. An amicus curiae is an individual and organization that is not necessarily a party to a legal case, something pending in court or beyond, but that party nonetheless permitted to assist a court, to assist a judicial officer by offering some information or expertise or insight that is a bearing on the issues in the case. The phrase, of course, not surprisingly, is legal Latin. And the origin of the term has probably been dated way back to 1605 to 1615. In America, we often see amicus briefs filed at appellate courts, including the United States Supreme Court. And indeed, when those briefs are filed at appellate court levels and at the Supreme Court level as well, they often deal with all kinds of issues important to our lives and livelihoods, including things like social policy, economics, academics, commercial issues, civil and human rights, and many, many things beyond just that. We take our name on this weekend broadcast, Amicus Law Review, from that notion that we are here as a civic media entity to provide some legal insights, some perspective, some assistance, some support, some less direction, but more counsel in the areas that are important in our lives, offering it up to you for your consideration and insight. How do these things in our lives have an impact upon us? What do they mean practically? And how, in fact, should we understand what's going on in our courts? As always, we make some focused identification and hopefully some clear exposition of some of the most important news stories in the areas of law and government, and yes, that delivery of justice to all of us. We articulate, hopefully as well, some explanations, some descriptions of the reasons why, exactly why those local and national and world events are relevant, why they're significant, and why they're meaningful in our lives. We provide on this broadcast an examination and an explanation of the practical trappings, the specific aspects of the legal, governmental, and sometimes the rule of law issues in those news stories that populate our lives. And finally, we offer some instruction, some perspective, some insight, if you will, consistent with the word amicus. On the intersection between law, both procedure and substance, with civic responsibility and engagement in our community, which ultimately is the mission of civic media, certainly the mission of this weekend program. Thank you once again for joining me. As always, we're taking your phone calls at 855-752-4842. And I am joined in the Waukesha studio of Civic Media this morning by my excellent producers. Their names are Anya and Abby. Anya and Abby are here with me to make this show go this weekend, and also to ensure that your phone calls, your insights, your questions in particular about the things that are on our syllabus on this, our 91st broadcast, are addressed, and that you have an opportunity to participate with us as an amicus as well, a friend of this radio broadcast, this radio station, as we pursue these many issues. Before we begin and talk about the specific things that are on our syllabus on this weekend, our weekly review of those issues, I want to note, as we often do, that our Constitution provides some direct and relevant contemporary insight into what we do in America and beyond. The very First Amendment to the Constitution says this: Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Let me repeat that. It's important to understand the very first words of the very First Amendment to our Constitution, the 10 of them, the Bill of Rights: Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Now, in the time since 1791, when that amendment was ratified by the states and became a part of our Constitution, the United States Supreme Court and other lower courts, including state courts, have also taken a look at what that language means. And a lot of that jurisprudence has developed based upon tradition and history, but also based upon the contemporary practices in our nation, understanding that judges live in the real world. I bring that to our attention this weekend on this broadcast of Amicus because we are at a special time in America, often happens in the springtime. We happen to be right in the middle of a number of important observations and events and occurrences inside some of the major religions in America and on the face of our planet. As you know, this is Holy Week for all of our Christian friends and associates. It is also the third week, the Holy Week of Ramadan, for our Muslim friends and colleagues out there. In a couple of weeks, beginning in mid to late April, it is the beginning of Passover for our Jewish friends. And yes, indeed, in mid-April, on April 13th, for our Sikh and Hindu and some of our Buddhist friends as well, it is the observance of Vaisakhi, which is sometimes regarded as the harvest festival, a spring festival. All of those things happening in America and, frankly, across the planet at the same time. Holy Week, Ramadan, Passover, Vaisakhi, for a diverse and wonderfully to-be-embraced set of religious entities, people affiliating as they are free to do under our Constitution, and to express their religious views, their spirituality, as they choose to do without any involvement of the Congress, meant more generally to include the government. That is the affirmation of our Constitution. That's the affirmation of our founding fathers. And we celebrate both the diversity and the wondrous inclusion of a nation where all these different religions and others as well can pursue their faith as they choose to do so, pursuant not only to the assurance that government will not affect that pursuit of their spirituality, of their own religious beliefs, and also acknowledging that implicit in that amendment, implicit in every word of our Constitution, is the notion of inclusion and diversity, and the notion that we are better if we are people who embrace those fundamental concepts and understand that it's through diversity that we've got a larger understanding of our world and the ways in which we behave toward each other and pursue our futures. We celebrate this morning all of those members of our diverse religious faiths in America who not only are observing their religious beliefs, but also doing it pursuant to the affirmation of our government in our Constitution in the very First Amendment to our Constitution that gives them that freedom, a freedom to pursue their religious beliefs without government entanglement and intrusion. Now, beyond that constitutional aspect, let's talk more about what's going to be happening in this, our weekend broadcast here on Amicus. First, we're going to be following up on a lot of the discussion that we had in our first broadcast under the name Amicus just last week. That was our 90th broadcast on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Today, our 91st, we're going to be following up on some of the significant oral arguments, one of them that happened just this past week in front of the United States Supreme Court. It's one of actually two cases involving reproductive rights and abortion in particular. We're going to spend some time going deeply into exactly what the Supreme Court had in front of it when it came to an argument about the legitimacy of the use of a drug called mifepristone. We've talked about that a lot, and we're going to talk about it more this weekend as we pursue our exploration of what the Supreme Court did just this past week. And then we're going to highlight some things coming up in the coming weeks before the United States Supreme Court. All of these cases, three of them in particular, relate to matters on our political and our commercial and, yes, indeed, our national agenda as we go forward. We're going to talk about a case called Fisher, another case called Trump versus the United States, and another one that we haven't spent a lot of time talking about on our broadcast called Moyle versus the United States. It is an underreported case related, again, to reproductive rights coming up for oral argument in April. We're going to talk about all of those this weekend on our broadcast. And then we're going to go back and do some updates on the two major cases that are pending against Donald Trump. One of them, the hush money case. There is a trial date now before the Manhattan judge, rescheduled just this past week. We're going to talk about what the trial judge did there in resolving the issue of calendaring. And then we're also going to talk about something called a gag order, a term that I do not especially like and embrace because I suspect that it sends a message to many people about something that's not in fact going on. We're going to do some commentary, some case notes, if you will, about that language and also talk about the order that the judge entered in that case, its propriety under the circumstances, and the reasons why it is significant that that would happen in this particular case and other cases out there. That's the hush money case coming up in New York in just about a couple of weeks from now. Then we're also going to go south and talk once again about the Georgia, also another criminal case, another state case pending in Fulton County, being prosecuted by a district attorney there as well. This one also related to election interference, an omnibus RICO prosecution in that district. We're going to talk about what's going on in that case and specifically some hearings held by the judge just this past week on motions to dismiss that prosecution offered up by the defendants, and then also what's going on with some appeals of his recent order related to the proposed but not accomplished disqualification of the district attorney. All of that coming up, followed by some review of other cases in the courts of our nation. All of that is coming up on Amicus Law Review this weekend on the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
Most of us can agree the decision to have an abortion should be between a person and their doctor. Politicians should have no say at all. Thankfully, Senator Tammy Baldwin is standing up for our rights and working to keep politicians out of our medical decisions. After Roe v. Wade, the court case that protected abortion rights, was overturned, Tammy Baldwin introduced the Women's Health Protection Act, which would ensure access to abortion everywhere in the United States, including here in Wisconsin. The bill would end extreme abortion bans that have no exceptions for rape, incest, or the life of the mother, and threaten doctors with criminal charges for providing abortion care. Senator Baldwin also introduced legislation that would protect the right to travel across state lines for reproductive health care and safeguard access to contraception. Call Senator Tammy Baldwin at 202-224-5653. Tell her thank you for fighting back against extreme abortion bans. Paid for by A Better Wisconsin Together, Inc.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for the Todd Allball Show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a law review, and I am your host for this hour and also next hour on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Delighted to have you with me and my wonderful producers, their names Anya and Abby. We are coming to you this weekend from the broadcast station of Civic Media in downtown Waukesha, but broadcasting once again throughout the state of Wisconsin and beyond. As always, we invite your questions, your comments, your inquiries, your insights to the matters that are on our aggressive but achievable syllabus this morning. That phone number is 855-752-4842. That number one more time is 855-752-4842. I promised at the start of our broadcast this weekend that we would spend some time once again talking about the United States Supreme Court. These nine members of our highest court in the land, appointed by various presidents upon the advice and consent of the United States Senate, that is also a provision in our United States Congress, and appointed for life. And that means that they do not have to stand for election. They are there as long as they choose to do so. And indeed, some of our justices have remained in those positions for extended periods of time, affecting dramatically the jurisprudence of our nation. This particular court, no exception to that. Clarence Thomas is soon, in a number of years, about to become the longest tenured justice in Supreme Court history. We know that the Supreme Court is presently in its 2023-2024 term. And as we have said previously on this broadcast, right now there are about 62 cases pending before the Supreme Court for decision among the quite literally thousands of cases in which litigants have sought review by the Supreme Court during the course of the past year or so. They chose 62 of those to review, and we have talked about many of those on this, our weekend broadcast. This morning, we're going to go back and we're going to talk more about a few of those cases that are on the docket for oral argument, including one that was argued just this past week. This case, again, comes in the wake of the major decision by the United States Supreme Court in June of 2022 to find that under the Constitution, overturning nearly 50 years of tradition and jurisprudence, that the Constitution of the United States no longer, and frankly, never did, according to the Constitution, incorporate a privacy right to abortion, to reproductive rights, and sending that issue, as you all well know, back to the states, to legislators, to state courts and other tribunals to make decisions about whether abortion is legal and under what terms and conditions. It was in the wake of that all-important decision called Dobbs, D-O-B-B-S, overturning Roe v. Wade, that many things have happened in our nation that affect, again, dramatically that reproductive right that was previously established for nearly half a century in our nation. And a part of that involves litigation. Along the way, a group of doctors petitioned a federal district court, a trial court, in northern Texas, presided over by a judge named Kazmarek, to find that the drug, the pharmaceutical called mifepristone, had not been properly authorized and approved by the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA. Now, the FDA, over the period of almost a quarter century, about 23 years, has done extensive testing and examination of this drug and determined over the time of those years, involving testing, involving examination, involving practical applications, this one of the two major drugs used to accomplish medical abortions in America, found that this drug, mifepristone, is safe and secure. Now, there's no drug in our use in pharmaceutical worlds that is completely without some side effects, and mifepristone is no exception to that. But the FDA, over the course of 23 or so years, determining that it is as safe as any drug can possibly be. Well, these doctors came forward into the federal court there in northern Texas and said, you know, we think that the determination made by the FDA in this particular case to approve and authorize the nationwide use of mifepristone is wrong, that it is not, in fact, predicated upon medical science, and we're going to challenge that. And indeed, Judge Kaczmarek, in a fairly stunning order, came back and said, you know, I agree with you. He himself, contrary to the FDA's advocacy, contrary to what the Department of Justice was asking him to do, which is to reaffirm the accessibility of mifepristone to Americans in all settings, he found that, in fact, the FDA had not properly exercised its oversight and authority and determined inappropriately that mifepristone was safe. And he did that based upon a few studies that have since, believe it or not, been determined to be unreliable and have been withdrawn by the very people, the very institutions that put those studies forth in the first place. But the judge nonetheless went ahead and did that. The case, of course, appealed to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. The Fifth Circuit, in its review of that lower court order by Judge Kaczmarek, found that while it was not going to embrace the core ruling of Judge Kaczmarek banning mifepristone, nonetheless supported some restrictions on access to it that made it virtually impossible or very challenging, at least, to get the drug. That case now goes up to the Supreme Court. And just this past Monday, as a part of its oral argument process, a majority of the Supreme Court justices appeared to be, yes, that's right, deeply skeptical over efforts to curtail the use of this widely used abortion pill, mifepristone. They called into question whether this group of anti-abortion doctors who had initially brought this case before Judge Kaczmarek and some organizations along with them actually even had a right to challenge the FDA approval of the medication. Significantly, some of the important comments from the bench on Tuesday of this past week from justices of the Supreme Court hearing oral argument about whether or not the Fifth Circuit and basically the lower court decision should stand. We have Justice Neil Gorsuch, who described this particular case as an effort by, as he described it, a handful of individuals. He raised the question whether it would stand as a prime example of turning what could be a small lawsuit into a nationwide legislative assembly on FDA rule or any other federal government action. Those are strong words coming from any justice. He was pointedly questioning the attorneys before him and echoing some views of the other justices that suggested that indeed the doctors here did not have standing. They were not able to establish the harm, the danger that would come to them by virtue of the continuation of accessibility of mifepristone. A decision by the justices, of course, anticipated in June. But we know that other justices pretty much align themselves with Justice Gorsuch. And this is one case where the tea leaves, reading from the oral argument of just this past week, indicate that the Supreme Court is likely going to overturn the Fifth Circuit decision. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, noting what she described as a mismatch between the anti-abortion doctors claiming they have experience and the remedy they are seeking. Gorsuch, of course, raising the similar point. The doctors asserted that it offends their moral beliefs to care for patients who have taken abortion pills, but asking the court, as Ketanji Brown Jackson said, to impose restrictions on the pill that would drastically, dramatically limit its availability for all patients. More of that discussion coming up on Amicus Law Review. Stay with us for all of that.
Where the fans own the team. This is the talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
ABC News, I'm Mark Remillard. Demonstrators gathering in Jerusalem today, the latest protest in the country calling for new elections and the removal of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu over his tactics in Israel's war against Hamas. Meanwhile, President Biden now facing criticism from some in his own party over his plan to send more fighter jets and bombs to Israel. Work continuing to cut up portions of twisted metal from the wreckage of the Francis Scott Key Bridge so it can be removed from the water and hauled away. Work is being conducted at the surface right now, says Maryland's governor, Wes Moore.
We have divers that are sitting on 24/7 standby. As soon as the conditions become safe enough for them to go back in the water, they go back in the water and they'll continue the recovery operations.
It's still not clear when the busy port of Baltimore will reopen. Turkey's main opposition party appears set to retain control over key cities in the country, according to preliminary results from local elections this weekend. The victory is a major upset to President Erdogan. This is ABC News.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
Marquette season comes to an end. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Men's college basketball. Marquette was favored to win, but lost to NC State 67-58. Head coach Shaka Smart on what's next.
I don't know. We just lost in the Sweet 16. I'm not really focused on legacy. I did tell the guys after the game in the locker room that, you know, our two seniors, Tyler Kolick and Osa Iguodaro, it's been an absolute honor to coach this entire group. The worst thing about losing today is that, you know, we don't have practice tomorrow. We don't have another game to prepare for.
Marquette's Tyler Kolick asked this after the game.
Tyler, like, how do you balance your individual accomplishments over the last couple of seasons?
I mean, not many people make it to the Sweet 16. You know, I'm just happy to be out there every time with my guys. Like Coach said, I'm just disappointed that it's over.
Baseball, the Brewers win again, 7-6 over the Mets. Milwaukee with 16 hits on Saturday. Elvis Peguero, the winning pitcher. The Brewers home opener Tuesday afternoon. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. On this Easter Sunday, plenty of clouds to contend with. Southeast winds developing, highs in the mid-40s. If you don't see some rain late in the day, it will arrive by Sunday night. Mostly cloudy, lower 30s. Rain chances continue Monday with highs in the mid-40s. Currently 44 degrees.
Some days I cover up because of my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis. Now I'm hitting the road with clearer skin thanks to Skyrizi, risankizumab riza, a prescription-only 150 milligram injection for adults who are candidates for systemic or phototherapy. With Skyrizi, 3 out of 4 people achieved 90% clearer skin at 4 months. And Skyrizi is just 4 doses a year after 2 starter doses.
Don't use if allergic to Skyrizi. Serious allergic reactions and an increased risk of infections or a lower ability to fight them may occur. Before treatment, your doctor should check for infection and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms, such as fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, or if you plan to or recently received a vaccine.
Thanks to Skyrizi, there's nothing on my skin, and that means everything. Doctor today about Skyrizi, the number one dermatologist prescribed biologic in psoriasis, and visit Skyrizi.com or call 1-866-SKYRIZI to learn more.
Do you owe back taxes? Call Tax Solutions now and get some help. For a limited time, the IRS offers a tax forgiveness program called the Fresh Start Initiative. Our team can make it easier for you to pay back taxes, avoid tax liens, and get a fresh start.
I call Tax Solutions now and they got the IRS off my back.
Call Tax Solutions now. 800-281-8193. 800-281-8193. 800-281-8193.
This message is for Shauna, my mom, who just finished her high school diploma. I wanted to say I'm so proud of you for finishing school. You told me it's never too late to achieve your dreams. I hope to make you as proud as you have made me.
When you graduate, they graduate. Finish your high school diploma for you and for them. Visit finishyourdiploma.org to find free and supportive adult education centers near you. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
From I-43 to I-41, this is the Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a law review, and you are joining me and my wonderful producer, Anya, here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. We are talking once again about all things SCOTUS, Supreme Court of the United States of America, specifically reviewing what happened this past week when the 9 members of our Supreme Court heard oral argument, this time for speaking with the justices, having them pepper you with questions about the merits and demerits of your particular case. This past week, the United States Supreme Court hearing oral arguments on this case involving the future of mifepristone in America, following Matthew Kaczmarek's decision way back in 2022 to basically ban the drug, based upon his determination, his finding that the FDA had not properly reviewed and approved the drug. The case before the Supreme Court called Food and Drug Administration versus Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine. And we know from the oral argument, reading once again the tea leaves of this oral argument, that virtually every single justice had a problem with this case being brought by the doctors and the organizations with which they affiliated, principally based upon the notion that there was no standing, no damages shown by these doctors, especially in the midst of some questioning by Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, also involving the Solicitor General, Elizabeth Preligar, about whether or not the doctors had alternatives, and particularly noting that the rights of the doctors could in fact be satisfied by a right that they already have, and that is a federal conscience protection that allowed the doctors to opt out of providing care they morally object to, adding more steam, if you will, to the argument that there is no standing here. And again, virtually all the justices seem to indicate, led by Neil Gorsuch, but certainly advanced by the others as well, this notion that not only is this case not properly here, but could open the door to tax upon the FDA beyond just this one, arguably, prompting other judges down the road to find, based upon their also equally unfounded bases, that a particular drug in some other area of medical administration is not sufficiently been vetted by the FDA. And so along the way, virtually all the members of the Supreme Court expressing great concern about this, suggesting once again that the justices will turn back and say that the Fifth Circuit, the lower court judge, got this wrong, and keeping mifepristone legal in America. In a dissent in another case in 2009, Justice Samuel Alito talked about the importance of the FDA. He was joined in that case by the Chief Justice, his name, of course, John Roberts, and also by Justice Antonin Scalia, alive at the time, a very vibrant and iconic member of the court. He praised the agency's expertise, saying, "The FDA has the benefit of the long view. The majority ruled that the agency's approval of a drug had not been displaced by the plaintiff's ability in that case to sue under a state law." The Justice Alito said, "Where the FDA determines in accordance with its statutory mandate that a drug is on balance safe, then the court's precedents prohibit any state from countermanding that determination." Again, a suggestion from the Supreme Court justices that they're not going to overturn this, even in the context of access to this very abortion bill, mifepristone. Way back in 2021, the Supreme Court affirmed the authority of the FDA in ruling on reinstating a requirement that women seeking to end their pregnancies use the pill, and that they're required to pick it up in person from a hospital or a medical office. A federal judge in Maryland had blocked that requirement because of the coronavirus pandemic and basically overrode the agency's determination. Chief Justice Roberts, in the context of that case, another case, not the one before the court this past week, but nonetheless on the docket at that time, Chief Justice Roberts was the only person who articulated expressly the reason for supporting the FDA in that case, said, "My view is that courts owe significant deference to the politically accountable entities with the background, competence, and expertise to assess public health. In light of these considerations, I do not see," the Chief Justice said, "I do not see a sufficient basis here for the district court, the trial court, to compel the FDA to alter the regimen for medical abortion." All those indications present of just this past week, and also historic based upon previous cases, indicate that in connection with the first case to appear before the Supreme Court in the wake of Dobbs having to do with abortion rights, reproductive rights, the Supreme Court is going to go in the direction of ensuring that access to this drug is available to women and would offer to their partners as well as we go forward and continue to wrestle nationwide with this issue of privacy rights and reproductive rights. The issue, of course, as that last quote indicated, also much tied up in these other issues that we have discussed a lot here on our weekend broadcast, and that is deference to an agency. We know that the Supreme Court also has other cases pending before it in which there are other challenges made by other people under other circumstances to the legitimacy of, for example, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and again, arguably many, many other agencies out there, an attack, if you will, upon the expertise, the science, the legitimacy of these agencies that have been operating in our behalf perfectly, no, with imperfection, but nonetheless, based upon their best, not only judgment, but expertise and insight, the science, the facts, all of that also on display in these other challenges before the Supreme Court that are also awaiting decision in June. A major one of them, called Loper Bright Enterprises, going to determine whether the fundamental notion of judicial deference to the agencies, that is, deferring to agencies in situations where their interpretations are reasonable, and the law itself, the statutes that are passed by Congress, are themselves ambiguous or in some way not clear. In that case as well, this Loper Bright Enterprises case, Supreme Court has before it a major case having to do with whether or not the Supreme Court and lower federal courts, the appeals courts, the trial courts, will in the future continue to offer up what's called Chevron deference when it comes to understanding and reviewing the decisions of our agencies. This issue, again, in this particular Mifepristone case, appears to be a case where the Supreme Court's going to side in favor of the agency. Other cases, unclear. Or at least when it comes to the Loper Bright Enterprises case, a lot of the Supreme Court justices seem to indicate they're willing to overrule the fundamental notion of deference, even if in its applicability to particular cases, they decide in the left way, the right way, the in-between way, all those kinds of things coming up down the road. And in that connection, another case coming up, not yet argued before the Supreme Court, but coming up for oral argument once again before the Supreme Court on April 24th, a case called Moyle versus United States. It is arguably, depending upon how you view this, yet another of these cases in the administrative realm, attacks upon agency decisions, or at least interpretations of the law, and also falling inside the category of reproductive rights, privacy rights. How does this particular case called Moyle, coming up for oral argument again in April, next month, how does that come to the Supreme Court? Well, it turns out the Biden administration had issued some guidance in 2022 following the Supreme Court decision in Dobbs, once again finding no privacy right in the Constitution for abortion. In the wake of that decision in Dobbs, the Biden administration issuing basically these regulations, again, administrative rules, interpreting something called the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, EMTALA, the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act. The interpretation, the rule that was issued by the Biden administration under that law passed by the Congress required that hospitals receiving Medicare funding, in other words, federal funding from the government, have to provide, are obliged to provide necessary stabilizing treatment to pregnant women in emergency situations. That's what the Biden administration, that's what the administrative decision was in 2022. And that interpretation, that rule, if you will, also included emergency abortions. And so once again, the issue before the court, well, it turns out that Idaho and the state legislature there challenged that rule, that administrative decision, and argued in part that the EMTALA, again, once again, this Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, conflicted with an Idaho law, that Idaho law called the Defense of Life Act, the Defense of Life Act. And what did that act do? Well, as the name of the law indicates, it bans abortions in the state. no abortions in the state of Idaho. And it turns out that the lower district court judge, Judge Winmill, in that case, W-I-N-M-I-L-L, issues a ruling in this U.S. district court in Idaho prohibiting Idaho. Idaho loses this case from enforcing the state law because it conflicted with EMTALA, basically saying under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, the federal law applies, the Idaho law prohibiting abortions does not, and the EMTALA is supreme to the lower court, the lower legislation in this area. U.S. District Court, that then goes up to the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit similarly agrees with the lower court, denies a request from the state to put the ruling on hold while the appeal process goes forward. And the United States Supreme Court, again, grants the writ of certiorari, which, again, is this recommendation, this decision to take the case on as a part of its present term. The court also granted a temporary hold on the district court ruling that required emergency rooms in Idaho to provide abortions in emergency situations. And so time is of the essence, again, in this case as well, all of that being argued before the Supreme Court on April 24th in this case called Moyle versus United States, a second case involving not just abortion, as significant, as important as that is, but also the role of agencies in America, what our Constitution means, what rulemaking means, and the future more generally of privacy rights in America. What other situations like this will be discussed before the Supreme Court on April 24th when it takes up Moyle versus United States, just as it did the case involving Mifepristone of this past week. We know as well that there are there are 10 cases altogether pending before the Supreme Court oral argument in the month of April. Two more in particular that we have talked a lot about on our weekend broadcast. And that is one case involving Fisher versus United States. He is this convicted defendant who is challenging the very statute under which he was convicted, a federal statute that prohibits the corrupt obstruction of government proceedings. He maintains before the lower courts and now before the Supreme Court that the statute does not apply to his conduct, and therefore his conviction, the judgment against him, the criminal judgment against him, entered by the federal district court in D.C., approved, supported by the federal appeals court in the District of Columbia, all of that should be overturned, and the Supreme Court should find that because the statute does not apply to his conduct, therefore his judgment should be vacated or reversed. The reason why Fisher is so important is because that same statute is one of the statutes that Jack Smith has used in prosecuting Donald Trump on the major election interference case that is now pending, not so much in the district court, not so much in the appellate court, but also before the Supreme Court, that having to do with election interference. And the reason why that case is also suspended is because there's a second case also coming up for oral argument in April, April 25th. That is Trump versus United States. And you all know what that case is about as well. That's the immunity case. That's the case in which Donald Trump himself, unlike the Fisher case where he is not named as a party, but the result could have an impact upon his prosecution, in Trump versus the United States being heard by the Supreme Court on April 25th, the Supreme Court going to decide whether there is such a thing as presidential executive immunity. As we have said often on this broadcast, a situation where the notion itself is beyond ridiculous, it is frivolous, it cannot be. And we need to anticipate that the Supreme Court, not only when it entertains oral argument on April 25th, but also when it returns a decision in June, that it is unanimous in saying that we do not have kings in our nation, we have presidents, and there is no such thing as immunity. All of that happening before the Supreme Court in the month of April and then in June, when we will continue to cover the work of the Supreme Court here on this broadcast station, here on Amicus, a law review.
The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
Hi, this is Scott Trout of Cordell & Cordell. If you're a dad who is facing divorce, there are extra layers of stress that may include stereotypes and assumptions. No two situations are the same. Our legal experience and dedication prepare us for whatever legal challenges we face together. You need a partner you can count on. For more than 30 years, Cordell & Cordell has represented men in divorce.
Schedule an appointment with one of Cordell & Cordell's Madison area attorneys. 1110 Fourier Drive, Suite 120, Madison, Wisconsin, 53717.
Looking for a roundup of the day's important headlines in a quick podcast form? Search no more. Find it now at WGBW.FM. Your news just for the Green Bay area. I'm Lisa Hale with WGBW News.
Fabulous Farm Bay PM Yankee here with the Midwest Farm Report live weekday mornings right here on WGBW. It's about your food and where it comes from. Tune in and learn. 5 a.m., 1590 a.m., 97.9 FM, the Talk of Green Bay.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Matt Nair on air.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel, your host this hour, and yes, next hour as well on our weekend broadcast, where we examine things like the rule of law and justice and government and lots of things having to do with courts in America in our first segments of this hour, talking about what's happening before the Supreme Court and promising, committing to you not only to continue to cover those oral arguments, to get a sense of what our Supreme Court is thinking about these major issues. 62 cases right now pending in front of them. 11 of those cases already decided, including, of course, one case involving Colorado and the decision by the Supreme Court to ensure that Donald Trump remains on the ballot in that case. Another case involving other issues out there having to do with the laws, the statutes of America, many other cases pending before the Supreme Court. And we will continue to monitor all of those cases as we go forward, including some very special broadcasts here in Civic Media in June and July, probably as well, talking about the actual resolutions, the decisions that will be rendered by the United States Supreme Court, most typically late May into June and perhaps even into July. Wouldn't be spending lots and lots of time doing deep dives, doing some of our microscopic justice, if you will, our analysis of those cases as they come out. We also spend time talking about other courts in America. And in this final segment of our first hour, no exception to that rule. We know that just last month, in a civil case, not a criminal case, a civil case pending in the Manhattan courts, a fellow named Arthur Engoron, he is the judge, presiding over this major valuations case in which the Attorney General of the state of New York, her name Letitia James, had charged successfully in the end that Donald Trump and others had undervalued, misvalued, misrepresented the values of various properties of his in violation of New York law, basically premised upon the notion that those violations resulted in losses to the state of New York because of the misstatements, the false statements made, revenues that they would otherwise have gotten if Donald Trump and others had properly valued his properties as a part of his obligation to account properly and to report properly on the actual values of those properties. Justice Arthur Engoron, in this major decision, had found that indeed the government, the state of New York, had established that a $454 million judgment was appropriate, reflecting the interest payments also that Donald Trump owed based upon these false valuations, an amount probably now approaching $500 million. And in addition to that, Justice Engoron had imposed some restrictions on Donald Trump and his family, barring him from running that New York company, obtaining a loan from a New York bank for 3 years, other things there, and applying those also to his adult sons for 2 years. Now, in a move just on Monday of this past week, Donald Trump got a favorable ruling from the appeals court. Donald Trump indicating that he is going to appeal that $454 million judgment entered by Judge or Justice Engoron to the appeals court. And he's going to attack it on substantive grounds, going to maintain, presumably, that there was not a sufficient evidentiary basis to make that finding, and that Justice Engoron did other things that erred in the determination of that ultimate judgment there. That will be a part of the substantive appeal. But along the way, in order to what's called perfect that appeal, to be able to accomplish that appeal in the first place, he had to place a bond basically to ensure that he will pay off that $454 million amount. In a recent court ruling, Trump's lawyers had identified and said to the judge that it's a practical impossibility and revealed that Donald Trump had gone to more than 30 companies in trying to identify one of them that would give him a sufficient amount of money to support this appeal. Stunningly, at about the same time, Donald Trump also went on social media and said, no, I'm entirely able to do this. I'm very wealthy. I can do just this, completely contrary to what his attorneys were saying in court. Well, as a part of this further litigation by those attorneys, by Donald Trump, they also sought a reduction from the Court of Appeals in the requirement, the amount of the bond that had to be posted. And indeed, just this past week, with the clock ticking, he had 30 days from the time of Justice Engoron entering this judgment before the attorney general could begin to execute on that amount, basically seizing properties, seizing bank monies, 30 days, the New York Appeals Court handed the former president a lifeline and on Monday said that it would accept a far smaller bond of only $175 million, reducing the bond, and not the amount of the judgment, but the bond necessary to perfect that appeal. This ruling by a panel of about five appellate judges was really a crucial and pretty much unexpected victory for Donald Trump. It basically staved off a looming financial disaster for him. Had the court denied that request for a smaller bond in this fraud case, which again brought by the attorney general, she was going to go ahead and begin to execute on the total amount of that. And he risked losing a control over his bank accounts and even some of his marquee properties right there in Manhattan, other places around the country. And that's what you do when you execute on a bond. What the appeals court said was, in order to protect this appeal, you do not have to post, if you will, through another company, the entire amount of the bond. Will accept $175 million instead. It's a major decision, a major procedural decision by this appeals court. Now, Donald Trump, from the date of the order reducing that amount of the bond, had 10 days, now about 5 days, to secure that bond. Some people with knowledge of his finances indicate that he may, in fact, be able to do that, based upon this promise from an outside company that will cover his judgment if he ultimately loses the appeal and cannot pay. And that company apparently agreeing to do this, pledging about $200 million in cash and some other investments as collateral to support the presentation of this $175 million bond. It looks as if sometime this coming week that will happen. And therefore, Donald Trump goes ahead and seeks review by the appeals court on the substantive grounds that Judge or Justice Engoron did not properly decide this case. And that appeal, then, that will take months, if not years, down the road. Lots of things have got to happen, including some initial review by the judges on the appeals court. Lots of other things involving the filing of briefs, perhaps oral arguments as well before that appeals court, before we hear the final word on whether or not this major, almost $500 million judgment in the civil arena should, in fact, be upheld. We'll continue to monitor all of that, even in the years much ahead. We continue with Amicus, a law review, more on justice, the rule of law, and government in our nation as we continue in our weekend broadcast.
From the home of the frozen tundra, Green Bay's choice for news talk, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
Save big money on everything for your bathroom project at Menards. Upgrade your bathroom with Max. With more than 1,000 shower doors, bathtubs, and shower kits, you're sure to find exactly what you need to add style and luxury to your bathroom. Plus, we have all the stylish faucets and bath hardware to finish your project. Check out our entire selection of Max bathroom products and our weekly flyer today on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Mark Remillard. The fallout from the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Maryland could